Welcome to the Recipes for Residency podcast, where we invite medical doctors from all stages of their training and ask them questions regarding their path to residency and how they were able to successfully match into the specialty of their choosing. And more importantly, the advice they would give to any student trying to match into the same field. My name is Austin Mefford. I'm a third-year medical student at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, Texas, and I will be your host. Today's guest is Dr. Philip Pippin. Dr. Pippin is an assistant professor of family medicine and associate program director for the family medicine residency program here at UT Health Science Center at Tyler. Dr. Pippin, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So typically what I like to do is I just like to have people kind of tell the listeners a little bit about themselves and kind of how they found their way to medicine.
Sure. Well, I went to med school at UTMB in Galveston and decided about halfway through school, right in the middle of third year, that I wanted to be a family doc. And so I applied to just about every residency in Texas and interviewed at most of them. And then landed in Tyler because I liked it here and stayed here hopefully forever.
Okay. So did you come to medical school kind of knowing, you said you kind of figured out third year. Did you come to medical school with a different plan?
Yes. My mother is a nurse in a cardiology clinic, so my exposure to medicine was cardiology. So I came to medical school thinking cardiology. And then one of my mentors early in medical school was a rheumatologist. And so then I thought, well, I want to be exactly like this guy. And so I did cardiology and rheumatology rotations to help figure that out. And process of elimination there.
Right. Okay. Talking about family medicine, I'm currently on my family medicine rotation here in Tyler. UTMB students, they send them kind of all over the state. And I'm from this area, so it was nice to come back here. When you're looking at family medicine residencies, this question, I guess, is a little bit out of order for people that are familiar with the structure of this podcast, but just kind of naturally going here, not all residencies are created equal, right? So, a lot of the residents here that I have spoken to, they say it's really nice because, you know, it's in a big city, but it's still small enough to where they get to do a lot of things. You know, there's not an ER residency program. And so a lot of the ER here is staffed by family medicine residents, and they get to do a lot of things. Are those type of things drawing factors for certain residency programs? And when you're looking at residency programs, how do you decide which one you want to go to?
Yeah, I only seriously considered unopposed programs, and that's the distinction in family medicine, opposed versus unopposed. Opposed means there's other residencies training residents in the same field that you're in. So for family medicine, opposition comes from OB, IR actually, most of your procedures are gone. Basically, internal medicine and all fellowships associated. And then sports medicine, which is usually from ortho. But if you have residents crowding out or monopolizing a patient population, then you would lose an aspect of your training. And family medicine's training is very broad. So programs try to set up in areas where they can be unopposed by other residencies. And the only residency in the county is family medicine. That used to be true for a lot of programs in Texas. And now it's true for almost no programs in Texas.
Right.
And you can imagine, as there's this nationwide shortage of residency positions, the challenge is not open more med schools. The call to leaders is open more residencies. So they're going everywhere. And so it's hard to find a truly unopposed program now.
Right. Well, and I mean, that's kind of similar to even on our clerkship rotations. I know we send people out to Alpine, which is on the moon. And it's like, you know, you go there and people say, oh, I delivered a baby, or I did this, or I did that. So the unopposed versus opposed, if you're looking for a family medicine program, I feel like it's kind of hard to find those, like you were saying, is there's not a lot of unopposed anymore.
Since you have to make a compromise saying, I don't want to live in Alpine, and because I don't want to live in Alpine, I'm going to limit my training. You have to just be honest with yourself. And if you know you're going to limit your training, you have to pick, in what ways do I want to limit my training?
Right.
And that's a lot of the residency selection process for someone who wants to be a family doctor.
Right.
catch you back to why do you want to be a family doctor?
Right. Well, and so that kind of leads us into other questions. So as far as someone applying to a family medicine program, so we talk about on this show really three things: research, letters of recommendation, and then mentorship slash, you know, general advice and guidance on how to get there. So typically where we start, and I know certain things are more relevant to certain residencies or certain programs than others, but specifically like when you were going through medical school, how much, or being on an associate program director here, if an applicant comes with research experience, how are you looking at that?
It's not highly valued in family medicine. And the argument behind that is that original research articles never show up in the American Family Physician Journal, which is the primary journal of family medicine. It's the journal of the AAFP. So if original research isn't a huge part of getting published in family medicine, it's hard to say that's the skill you need to develop for your scholarly activity. I'll tell you what does get published every single edition is a review article of some condition. And the primary skill for writing a review article is the ability to review the literature, ensure that you caught everything, so all available trials, critically appraise the trials, summarize findings, and then make them relevant to patients. And that's stuff you learn in med school as well. It's a different set of skills from research.
Mm-hmm.
So research is not highly valued. Work experience is. I've actually seen applications the past few years. The frequency of scribe work has gone up. And at first I thought that was weird because I had never seen that. I didn't have any friends who were scribes. And now I see that the med students who have been scribes, or the interns who come in who took a year off to scribe, are really fantastic. It's a valuable skill. And so I actually consider that when I'm looking at an application, was there work experience scribing? Volunteer experience, we just expect some sort of, not an empty spot on the application.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, it's so when you're talking about scribing experience, is this like prior to coming into medical school?
Everyone does it differently. That's another thing I'm seeing reviewing applications is the path through medical school and into residency is so varied. It's not just college, med school, residency. And so some people take time off before med school. Some people take time off during med school. Some people work a job during med school. And some people take time off after med school. Anything that's not typical is going to get looked at with a critical eye. But a critical eye is not always a bad thing, because they might look at your application closely and discover something good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they spent 2 years as a scribe in one of the busiest ERs in the state.
Right.
This person knows how to write a note.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, basically, having an application that's a little deviant from what you would typically see as traditional is not necessarily a bad thing. You just need to be able to talk about it or explain it.
Right. Okay. It's not going to hold you back in family medicine. I mean, I know when I was a student, which wasn't that long ago, a lot of the discussion of where you're going to go to residency was about how competitive is your application?
Mm-hmm.
How competitive are you? And some of that's personality, like how ambitious are you? So that's the same question at the beginning. Why do you want to be a family doctor? But when I look at an application for family medicine, I'm not looking for the most competitive applicant, because we have 8 slots and we interview just over 100. And we usually get the top third-ish of our rank list. I know our program director makes some tweaks at the end, so I can't promise that. He might be moving people around.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's usually a nice match.
Mm-hmm.
when we match applicants. People want to be here, and we want them. And I think most family medicine programs are like that, is you have a pretty large residency size, and the applicant pool is manageable. And so it's not like you have to blow everybody away with your application.
Right. So how common is it? You were saying that you applied to all, if not almost all.
I think I applied to 20 Texas programs and I interviewed at 11.
Okay.
And so the only reason I started canceling interviews is I got tired. It was halfway through January. I was just done. I already knew where I wanted to go.
Right. Right. Well, that is I'm jealous. I mean, hopefully, I mean, a lot of people listening can have that same experience, but especially with the new Zoom interviews, the virtual format, which we'll kind of touch on a little bit later, it may be similar that way. But is that pretty typical? I mean, do people, and it's different for every program, but so for people applying to, let's say, orthopedics, they're going to apply to every single program.
It's a totally different animal. I mean, competitive specialties. I didn't do it, so I can't give you any advice. I don't know. My application was boring. I had no research during med school. It was all undergrad and volunteering. I had very little. It's almost a miracle that I didn't just get overlooked because I had a single page CV.
Who did you have to pay?
Yeah, good question. I think I just charmed them.
So there you go. I mean,
in-person interviews.
Exactly. The beauty of the interpersonal skills is definitely cannot be overstated. But kind of going along with that, the Zoom interviews, right? Because you miss a little bit of that, you know? I mean, you don't know if these people are wearing pants. You don't know, like, how cool they are. You know, people have, like, weird backgrounds and things. People stage their backgrounds, which I think is also more weird than having, like, a weird background. I mean, is that... I mean, how has that affected the interviewing process?
Well, none of us liked it.
Right.
Interviewing in our offices, looking at a screen, very different. You can't pick up on the cues we're used to picking up. We interview patients all day. This is our job.
And so, right.
But it worked out really well. We're very happy with our current intern class. And we all were sitting around as a faculty group, kind of surprised and scratching our heads. How did this work out? Like, it's not like we did anything special. We just had a Zoom call with people. Mm-hmm. And it's also a surprise to me that so many people were happy to come here without actually coming to see this place. And
right.
So, but I guess maybe other places were struggling, and so the bar was set low this year. I don't know. But.
Were you guys able to interview more people than you originally would?
Yeah, we absolutely did. Our standards for screening applications went way down. We took a lot of applications we're not used to reading because we only have 6 core faculty.
Right.
And so if you get 500 applications, you're not reading 500 applications.
Right.
I usually read about 30. Read the letters, read the MISP, look at the grades, try to piece together the narrative of what happened.
Right.
That you can't do that for everybody. That takes like 5 minutes.
Right.
And so that's going to add up. These are faculty members.
Right.
So I usually do about 30. Other core faculty do 20, 30. Dr. Menard always does 100 plus. He's the program director. Mm-hmm. He sits in his office for hours and it sends us emails at midnight about people. Mm-hmm. And he was reading applications and finding good stories and little details that he thought really boosted an application that we would have normally screened out. And so we said it doesn't cost anything to interview these people. We were throwing people on at odd hours saying, oh, my patient's not here. I'm going to go interview someone. So that was an advantage. We got to interview more
people. But what an interesting narrative, though. I mean, we're talking about lowering those kind of core, you know, objective standards, but then the residency class that you have, you're like very content with it. But I know as far as logistics are concerned, I mean, it's impossible to be able to do that depending on how many applications you get, how many you can actually read. Cause like you said, there's only 6 of you and you can't read every single
one. There's 6 of us. I don't know how many applications we usually get. I know we get a lot that get automatically screened out by whatever they put in Aris. They mm-hmm. put these filters. And so we don't see most of the applications that come. But we're limited. I'd say if we do 40 each, we could actually review 240 applications well. Outside of that, I mean, if we don't have some sort of screening and we're going to get overwhelmed.
Right.
So we're missing people. We're missing excellent candidates. I'm sure of it. I know because sometimes when we've stretched it out or got an email from someone saying, hey, did you consider this application? I actually went and looked at it and we're like, yeah, we will consider this application, even though it didn't meet the screening.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, do you see that? And we've had this kind of echoed a couple times on the show, just people saying to, because, and I go back and forth, because there's a fine line between being persistent and being annoying. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, do you see those people that are persistent and they will email you directly and be like, hello, this is me. I'm here. You know, you ignored me, but I'm going to be annoying for a second. And then you look at their application, you say, oh, maybe we should invite this person. And then it actually works out. I mean, is that a Cinderella story or does it happen?
It has worked. That has happened here. It depends on your program director. Our program director has a bleeding heart. And when he hears a good story, I mean, I'm not kidding. At midnight, he will send an email to the core faculty. And I often wake up because I hear a notification.
Right.
And he says, please review this application. I'm like, oh, my gosh. I can tell you, though, it is annoying. It's definitely annoying. We're all annoyed. We talk about it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And you might end up having a fairly bad reputation and still not getting into the program. What's the alternative? They didn't know me and I didn't get into the program. So it might be worth it. If you hadn't got enough interviews, it might be worth it to reach out directly.
Right.
Even though it's very annoying.
Interesting. Well, that's what I'm saying. The worst they can say is no. I mean, it's no either way. If you're annoying somebody at a different program that you're never going to see, then I guess it depends on what kind of person you are. I would not have a problem annoying someone I'm never going to meet in person or work with. But okay, so kind of backtracking a little bit here. So when we're talking about letters of recommendation or things that we're sending, when you're reading letters of recommendation, the vast majority of them, and this is just me speaking kind of what I've learned from previous interviews, the vast majority of them are boring. They're very bland. It's a template in your computer that you change the name and they send it, right? So, I mean, how does an applicant, if you're applying to a family medicine program, how are you approaching faculty and what faculty are you approaching for like a strong letter of recommendation?
Someone, the strongest letters and that I, when I review an application are come from someone that I know personally. A family doctor that I have met and trust. And that's either a graduate of our program or someone from UTMB who trained me or a department chair of somewhere who I heard give a talk. And so that depends on how many people I know, which is not enough. And so you can't totally depend on that, but that's one. So if you're applying somewhere and a graduate of that program wrote you a letter, you've gotten in automatically. It doesn't mean you're going to get highly ranked, but you will be considered.
Sure.
Another thing I look at is, did that person know you? And so, like you said, template letters where it's obvious there was just a name replacement, those get very quickly overlooked. You scan the letter, they show up usually on a single page in ARIS as a PDF file. I click it, maximize it on my screen. The first thing I do is read who wrote it. Second thing I do is read, does it say family medicine? So many say dermatology or orthopedic surgery. I mean, and unless you specify to your letter writer where it's going, you don't know what they're going to write. And they might write something about a conversation they had with you at lunch. We've seen it. I see it all the time. And in family medicine, that's a big turnoff because we actually like our profession. And I know family medicine gets a bad rap in med school because it's not that competitive. Well, just because it's not that competitive doesn't mean it's an excellent job. So everyone's so ambitious. They're like, I want to make the most money I possibly can. I want to live this life and I want to have this level of prestige. Therefore, all you guys are just the losers who are leftovers. Now, I'd say that's probably different program by program in family medicine. There are some family medicine programs that really never had an intention of producing excellent physicians. They just exist to meet a need in the community.
Sure.
So it's not very aspirational. But if you see a letter that makes it suggest I'm applying to family medicine as a backup because it's not competitive, that's so bad. Mm-hmm. It's just over. Your application's gone. And you didn't want to be here anyway, so who cares?
Right.
The match is a two-way street. We want you and you want us.
Right.
Let's see. So did they know you? Is there anything in the letter that suggests they personally worked with you? They actually saw you examine or speak to a patient or operate on a patient
sure.
or something? I don't care so much about what the specialty is of the letter writer. It's family medicine applies to everything. So
sure.
your skills in the operating room do matter in family medicine. Your skills in interviewing mentally ill patients do matter very much. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not concerned about the specialty. I just want to know, did they know you? I also want to know if I know them. We already talked about that. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to have a department chair letter from family medicine. You can get a department chair letter from another specialty, and it'll still show up in ARIS as department chair letter. But then we scroll down and say, oh, it's pediatrics. And there's always the question of, are they also applying to pediatrics? It's just always there. And so I know I write letters. I wrote 4 letters last week. I'm going to write one this morning from students who rotate on this clerkship primarily, and also the AIs who come here. I make it clear that I've worked with them and observed them. I don't have a template. I could show you my template. It's a letterhead, AMCID with a fill in the blank. And I usually do 3 paragraphs. The first one is an introduction, how I know this person. They rotated on an AI or clerkship. The second one is my observations from direct observation of clinical skills and notes that were written. And then the third one is the, intangible qualities, that whatever I saw that sets this applicant apart from others.
Sure.
And for many students, that's actually how we get to the discussion of, I might be able to write you a good letter. Is it's not just you had a great rotation, but I think you have something that's going to make your program director's life easier. For instance, they're never going to have to remediate you in an area of clinical skills. And they're not going to have to fire you or reprimand you for professionalism concerns. Your communication skills are up to date. If you're going to be a lifelong learner and a professional, I can recommend you strongly. Mm-hmm. I don't need much more information than that.
Right.
And so if I pick up on that, that's usually my third paragraph, and then the letter goes through.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've had people, I was kind of shocked whenever I heard this, but we've had people on the show kind of say that they've read bad letters of recommendation. That
happens.
They've had people, students will say, can you write me a letter of recommendation? And they don't specify good or strong or whatever. And they're like, sure. Yeah. And then they say like, I don't know if I would recommend this person. That's like kind of sabotage, I feel like.
Well, it's a student's fault in that case. So, because the advice is ubiquitous. When you ask for a letter of recommendation, choose the person you ask from to make sure there's someone who has a favorable view of you. That means you have received positive feedback from that individual, net positive feedback.
Sure.
And then when you ask them, don't just say, hey, I need a letter. So give that person some motivation that they're actually investing in your career and in your future. Mm-hmm. And say, you gave me such and such positive feedback on the rotation. I was wondering if you could say similar things in a letter of recommendation to build a strong case for my application to residency.
Right.
Something, the word strong is good.
Right.
I had a student ask me, can I, 2 years ago, and it was, I guess it was maybe 3 years ago because it was 2 cycles ago, but it was, can you write a letter? And very generic. And I said, I'll get back to you, because my immediate response in my head was, no, I can't recommend you strongly. And you should know that, actually, based on our feedback.
Right.
You should already know that. Are you oblivious to it? I don't understand. And then I got back to him later saying, I can't write you a strong letter, but I'm willing to write you a letter. And he said, no, he'll ask someone else. So, yeah. That's one way to avoid the sabotage accusation, but. It's the truth.
Well, that's good for you, though. I mean, being able to be upfront saying that, some people would just be like, yeah, sure. And then it's bad. And I mean, I'm sure that doesn't happen all too often, but the fact that it does happen is pretty. But you're right. It's the student's responsibility to kind of make sure that they know exactly who is writing their letter. But when we're talking about, sorry, all my emails are going off like crazy. When we're talking about like away rotations. So I feel like in a program that's kind of in, you know, Tyler, Texas, it's a big city, but it's not, you know, Austin or Houston or Dallas. Are away rotations a very popular option here? And I know I've spoken with this by a couple of other, the faculty that were here, and they said that they have had people come here from the away rotations. And then when they leave, they're like, thank the Lord that person came here, because we know we do not want that person at our program. Is that pretty?
It can backfire.
Yeah.
And the reason it would backfire is something interpersonal. You created a feud among the residents, or there were professionalism concerns. I've got two. I don't forget these people. These away rotations that just went bad. I've got two in my mind right now, and both of them were professionalism concerns. And you can't hide that if you spend a month with somebody.
Right.
It will come out. And so you probably just need to pick another career, but you need feedback to know that.
Right.
And so if you made it all the way to fourth year and you think you're hot stuff and no one's told you about this glaring professionalism concern, probably it's just going to result in no matching because no one's going to fix it by now.
Right. So,
but we definitely pick that up. And we're so glad when that happens.
Right.
Usually away rotations are very positive because you come and what you do is you differentiate a bland application from all the other bland applications. Bland meaning there was nothing special.
Sure.
Even though your scores were fine, your grades were fine, your letters were positive. They're almost always positive. It's hard to separate your application from another. And so an away rotation just nails it if you do well.
Right.
I mean, those are always ranked very highly. People who have good applications, not all-star, but do well in away rotations here, we rank them highly.
So, kind of moving into that, and then just a couple more questions that we can wrap up. The away rotation, so when you have a student that's rotating on your service, whether it be an AI or me on my clerkship or whatever, what kind of qualities are you looking at in a student? What type of expectations do you have for them?
This is family medicine. So what do we do all day? We see people of all ages and all walks of life for every condition. We see healthy people and sick people within the same 20 minutes. And we see inpatients and outpatients and ER patients and procedure patients. So we're looking for someone with a breadth of knowledge and skills. Someone who is willing to learn new things. Someone who's willing to get in there. You can't do family medicine without seeing things you're unfamiliar with or that make you uncomfortable. So we're looking for someone who's willing to learn when they're uncomfortable. As a student, what that manifests as is just willing to go in a room and see a patient, willing to do work, willing to stay late. Don't roll your eye and shrug your shoulders when a new admission comes. When two things have to happen at the same time, we got a patient who has an abnormal EKG and you haven't gone back in the room yet. You got a patient with some terrible abnormal vital and they look like they're under stress. You have to be two places at once. Do you lose it or do you remain calm? And so we're just looking for hardworking professionals who actually want to be family doctors. And if you come to a family medicine rotation and say, like, who would want to do this? I don't want to do this. Then don't do it.
Right.
So go somewhere else.
Right. Right. Well, that was my thing. It was funny. I'm just interested in surgery and I was very upfront with everybody and people, there's different methodologies on this. Some people lie every rotation they're on and be like, oh man, I was born wanting to be a family doc, or some people want, and then they go to their derm rotation. They're like, I really want to do dermatology. And then they just switch every time. But what I've noticed is that I have enjoyed every rotation that I've been on thus far. And hopefully, and the people that I've interacted with have tried, Dr. Tran, one of the other faculty here, has been trying since day one to get me to be a family doc here, always trying to plant like ideas in my brain to make me question what I want to do. Ideally, that's what you want. If you are with students and you think this student would be good, you are going to try, you like what you do and you're going to be an advocate for your profession. Mm-hmm. And if you meet doctors that are not trying to convince you to do what they do, then maybe they don't like what they do as much. You know what I mean? So I see that. I've seen that a lot. And I've seen that on my other rotations that I've been on as well. But I enjoy family medicine. And I, like you said, there's a breadth of things here. And I think that's one of the most attractive things about this field. So miscellaneous questions here, just wrapping up. So step one being pass fail. Typically we ask this about, you're shaking your head very like enthusiastically. So what do we think about that?
Well, my step one was better than my step two, so that would have been bad for me.
Okay. Most people say you're usually trying to improve from your step one.
Score. I know. And I think that's, I don't care at all. So the important thing is that you have a score. So step two is now step one for our applications. Yep. I don't know what other people are saying, but that's what it is. So if you don't have a step two, your application's going to get maybe blown over by all the others who do have a step two, even though, I don't know, is it hard to get your score back in time this year with COVID and all that?
Maybe.
We'll be very understanding.
I'm sure.
We're an understanding application group when we all get together. But yeah, I think it doesn't matter at all to me.
Well, and step two is kind of more, I mean, clinically applicant. I mean, we interviewed family or internal medicine, and I feel like step two, honestly, probably more relevant for family medicine and internal medicine alike than step one. So
I agree.
Step two is definitely going to kind of take the place of step one. So, and just looking here, so kind of wrapping up, so resources. So I know you guys have been harping on the AAFP since I've walked in the door. What type of resources? Yeah,
it's not all groupthink. It's not just dogma. But I mean, look at this stack of AAFP or AFP journals. They have really useful review articles. And also little snippets like the poems and the help desk answers. Unless you read the journal, you don't know what these things are for the most part.
Right.
Nice brief evidence reviews so you can just apply something to your practice. Mm-hmm. There's some other journals. I get JAMA, so I read JAMA. These are my JAMA stacks I haven't worked through yet. But usually when I have some downtime, I'll knock out the stack and just stay current. The AFP website is probably better than the journal itself because it has all the articles, but they're organized by topic and you can search. And then it has questions, practice questions that come out of the journal, that come out of CME questions, but they're basically, they're board style questions and, very useful. I encourage students to use those on their rotation to practice for whatever exam they're going to take. I think most people do your world. That's fine. I did only AFP questions and my shelf went fine. I think they're very relevant to family medicine.
Right.
So that's the main resource.
So did they have resources for medical students that are pursuing a career in family medicine as well? Or is this just more so like review articles and things like that?
Right. So I didn't use anything like that. I think your school branch of the family medicine interest group is going to join either the TAFP or the AAFP and go to a conference and have networking sessions there and also some sort of topic about why you might be interested in family medicine. Mm-hmm. So that'd probably be the resource in that for launching a career in family medicine,
right,
is your local state branch of the AAFP or the American Association of Family Physicians.
Okay. Yeah, so I'll definitely link, I can link those resources and kind of put it in the show notes for everybody that's listening here. But typically, also what I like to do is I link our emails in the show notes in case anybody has any questions, mm-hmm, they want to follow up or ask you questions about this program in Tyler. But that's pretty much all the questions that we have for today. Thanks so much for joining. Was it miserable?
No,
it wasn't great. That miserable. It was fine.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you guys for listening and stay tuned for more ingredients on the Recipes for Residency podcast.